We have two new pages with us, and if you would, just come up and introduce yourselves to members and tell us your names, where you're from, and anything else you'd like to say for just a second.
Thank you. My name is Colin Furness, and I'm originally from Owatonna, and I'm just a graduate of the University of Iowa.
I'm David Studer. This is my first year at the Capitol, and it's a pleasure to work for all of you.
We're glad to have you here, and we hope you learn as much as we do, because this is like taking a college course every year, I think. And to start our college course with, there are three reports that we ask for, and there's a list in your packet, members. And we're going to be hearing all three but two today. They're all on groundwater. And if you'll remember that the constitutional money said two things. One, protect groundwater from degradation. And the second one was protect drinking water sources. And so at least 5% of the money is to be used to protect drinking water sources. So we didn't have plans. The agencies didn't have a lot of plans on the table for those kinds of things. So what we asked for was for reports for this year. We set aside $5 million for groundwater, but said that it could not be spent until the legislature appropriated it to a specific plan. And that's what we will be working, one of the things that we will be looking at in this committee during this session. So these are just, this is the language of the reports that we'll be looking at. And we're going to start with the two DNR one. We're going to, after we do these reports, the next thing we're going to do is ask the agencies to let us know. They have been required in the last legislative session with the budget to put the budget up on the website so the public could see, Minnesotans could see exactly what they're getting for the money and the outcomes. So those outcomes budget should be up on the web. We want to make sure they're clear, people understand exactly what they're getting for their money. So that will be the next thing we do, and then we'll get in. We haven't gotten the governor's budget recommendations yet, but this is the setup for that. And just to get it out of the way, we will do the LCCMR bill on Thursday, because I suspect once we get into the budget that is going to take an immense amount of our time. So these are the things we're going to do preliminarily to get ready for that. Any questions about process, procedure here? Representative Horton?
The bill that we have on our agenda on Thursday, is that the supplemental budget bill, which is basically where we'll have to make any cuts if our committee has a cut target?
No, the bill is the lottery money. It's the expenditure of the lottery money. And that, remember, there is an advisory committee, and that bill, that's the advice of the advisory committee, reduced to a bill, and we'll have a presentation of that. Any other questions, members? And then at the end of this session, I'm going to have our fiscal analyst go over the spreadsheet he did on parks. Remember, we had one on trails. We promised you we would do one on parks, and then we said, well, we need to continue with that, and I'm going to ask for one on WMAs and AMAs. These are just things we will continue to go through until we get the job done. With that, welcome to DNR.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Kent Lacasmo, Director of the Division of Waters. And Madam Chairman, you already outlined the law that we were complying with to do these two reports, and I wanted to just quickly tick this off and then hand it off to the authors of these two reports. The there we go. So the two reports that you have in your packet, we'll talk first about the green one, which is the long-term protection of the state's surface and groundwaters, and then secondly was the blue report, which is the plan for a groundwater level monitoring network for the 11-county metropolitan area. And the background, which you already handed out, Madam Chairman, is the statutory background for these two reports. This is just the language that you've already handed out. And we can start then with the first report, which is a long-term protection. And with me is Dave Luthi, the administrator of the technical service section, and Jeanette Leet in the groundwater technical services section.
Good morning. I'll start you out on the cover of the first report. My name is Dave Luthi. I'm the Technical Resources Section Administrator for the DNR Division of Waters.
I'm Jeanette Leet, Unit Supervisor for Groundwater and Hydrogeology, DNR Waters.
As I stated, we'll start out on the cover of the long-term protection report. The five circles on the bottom are something that we put on there for a specific reason. The ecosystem, surface water, land use, groundwater, and soils are all components of what will be necessary to provide the long-term protection of our state's surface and groundwater resources. We'll start out with ecosystem services. These are important functions that we have to have in order to provide for the protection of groundwater resources. As we attempt to manage our lands, our waters, we need to manage our lands first because the groundwater and surface waters are dependent on our land use functions and how we manage those systems. We cannot live without functioning ecosystem services. The biodiversity that underlies all these ecosystems is important to the functions that clean up our water and protect our environment and provide the quality of life that we look for. Land use impacts, the biodiversity, and the flow pathways that affect these ecosystem services. So as water falls off from the precipitation onto the landscape, it moves through these systems, both the plant communities, animal communities, and off the landscape into surface waters and into groundwaters. I will promote that only significant philosophical change in the way we manage our lands and waters will allow us to provide for short and long-term protection. We have managed our landscapes in terms of moving it off as fast as possible in most of the ways we make our choices. If we're going to provide for the protection of our surface and groundwaters, we need to slow it down, hold it on the landscape, and allow natural systems to treat and purify that water if we're going to have it protected. I'll bring you to this slide. As we settled the Minnesota, we were blessed with a tremendous biodiversity on the landscape, tall grass prairies, forests, floodplains, wetlands. We have modified that significantly as we've changed the landscape to provide for the services we need as we've grown and developed. If you look at the right side, those are the parts of the state either have been cultivated or urbanized, and as we've changed those land uses, we've changed the functions that protect and purify the waters that we depend on. So we're going to need to manage those systems more carefully going into the future if they're going to provide the services we need from them. An example of what it looked like in a natural system as we first settled the landscape, there was water everywhere. And I think this is part of our problem is that it was in our way. It was all over the place. You couldn't get from here to there in many cases because there was water all over the place. And so transportation systems, cropping systems, all needed to change that landscape in order to turn it into productive systems that we depend on for food and transportation. And living. We want water away from us, and so we have moved it to get it off. We had a landscape with water basically sitting all over the place, and as we have converted that to functioning systems of our needs, we've eliminated the water off the system, and we've eliminated a lot of the ecosystem services or the natural plant communities that provided those functions. And so as we move forward, we're going to need to address how we're going to manage those systems more carefully. Every activity that we do alters the the land that alters the land alters the water pathways. And so as the water again falls from the atmosphere, it traveled across to complex systems that slowed it down and filtered it. Now it travels in much faster pathways. We have put in drainage systems, we put in tiling, we put in impervious surfaces. Water falls, it runs off very quickly, carries a lot of stuff with it as it moves. And as we will point out, we're going to get into 103A, the policy section of the law that talks about land occupiers and all levels of government have to be involved if we're going to manage the system to protect the surface and groundwater resources. And we're going to need active engagement and efficient coordination between all partners. And with this, I'll hand it off to Jenny.
In a statewide sense, then, we needed to take a view at what we have going still in our ecosystem services that we might need to slate for extra protection. This image shows in red areas that still have significant biodiversity. They've been mapped by the County Biological Survey. Note that mapping is not complete, and of course you know that there are significant resources up in the big bogs. Remember them, they're just not on the map yet. And then in blue you'll see high topography, steep slopes. These are areas that have to be kept intact to protect downgradient waters, and in a lot of cases these are areas that depend on water table being near the surface. Imagine a groundwater seep, perhaps. Imagine vegetation on the slope that's holding the slope in place. So these areas may warrant then special consideration. If somebody wants to do something that would drastically alter it, we would have to work with them to find the least damaging way to carry out the project or to change the project so there would be no damage. We moved to a statewide overview of what water resources concerns might be. The map on the right-hand side was the way we chose to show that there is almost no place in the state where there are no surface water concerns. Take out the negatives. There are surface water concerns everywhere in the state. The map is the map of impaired waters. On the left is our map of types of places, we call them hydrogeologic settings, where we would expect to have either water quantity or water quality problems. Now you've probably heard a lot about karst, so look down to the southeast and see the area that's tinted in yellow. Typically limestone is the first bedrock, and if it's got significant cracks for water to move through, well, contaminants could get from the land surface into the aquifers relatively quickly. Well, what might be the issue up in the northeast? You see that we've colored that most places. Well, our groundwater concern up there would be, well, it's pretty hard rock, really close to the surface, and it's a crapshoot if you're going to get a well. So many of the larger communities, of course, are using lake water. Note that for some reason Lake Superior is colored in as impaired. Well, and another thing up in the Arrowhead is that if you do drill a well, it can happen that you'll get salty water from your well. So that's a groundwater concern. Down in the southwest, we've got it colored, same color as up in the far northwest, where pretty much the glaciers left us clay in the near surface. Every time a glacier came through and there was an interval between glaciations, stream networks would develop on top of that layer. And in those stream networks, the winnowing and the processes would have created, say, sands, alluvial materials. Gets buried again, those sands could be the aquifers we're drilling for. But they're sandwiched in these clays. We can't see them from up above. So another risky undertaking to try to get a well in those gray tinted areas. And then the dark gray tinted area is the Red River Valley, and well, you know about that, that's all clay. Very isolated sand stringers within that. There's little purple lines all along the upper edge of that dark gray area. Those are the beach ridge systems. very sandy at the surface, vulnerable therefore to contamination, and we have found significant biological resources on the downs gradient side where that water comes back out. The big place in the middle that has stippling all over it, those are the where there are sands at the surface, vulnerable to contamination. And then look back at the metro area, you'll see that we've got it crosshatched because as population grows, demands on the resource increase. So this is a pretty big problem. What should our strategy be? It's clear from what we've already talked about that we can only change things if we are working with the people who do things. And it's also clear from what we all know is that we have to reach people when they're just growing up. And if we didn't reach them then, we have to really work to teach them and help them learn what they need to know to make good management decisions when they are the county commissioner, when they're on the school board. Just to make the point, you're probably not old enough, but there was this litter bug campaign when I was like in first grade. My dad rolled down the window, threw out a chewing gum wrapper. I called him a litter bug, and he never did it again. If we get to the kids with some basic behavior changes, we'll have a chance. We need to help people figure out what they can do on the land. We need these best management practices. We can't just do it for a little bit and stop, think it's fixed. This has to be a long-term thing. That county commissioner is not going to be county commissioner maybe 10 years from now, so you have to keep educating, you have to keep working. We have to have the information to share. And we have to work in a watershed context. We know there's not much point in fixing a downstream problem if upstream issues are still going to bring the problem down. A current example of how this approach is being used is over at PCA with the TMDL process. Watersheds are being assessed, problems are being figured out, approaches to solving problems are being worked on, and we cycle around again inside the watershed so we can work on it in a holistic sense.
Fortunately, past legislature have given us some solutions. This is 103A205, rainwater conservation policy. It was actually first adopted in 1961, and it provides some excellent recommendations about what we need to do to protect surface and groundwater resources. And says it's policies of the state to promote the retention and conservation of all water precipitated from the atmosphere in areas where it falls. Simply placed, we have to hold the water on the landscape closer to where it falls and use natural systems to treat it.
On that, what are agencies doing to comply with that or make sure we comply with that law?
Well, I would say that this reaches across all agencies and governments as it's written, and I think that there have been attempts by most agencies and governments to deal with this to a degree. This exists really in policy statutes, so there isn't really a companion law that says who needs to implement this or how everybody needs to implement it. And if you look at 103A204, which I haven't provided here, is the groundwater protection policy. It says what we should be doing. 103H actually then says what each agency's role in doing that should be. There isn't a companion law that says how we should be holding water in the landscape and what each government and agency should be doing. And so I think that it's not being done as well as we probably need it to be. In fact, if you look at most systems, as I said earlier before, is that because of the way we have needed to manage the landscape, we've tried to get it off as fast as possible. We need to do that for cropping systems for yields, otherwise we lose crop yields. We have done that as we've developed because we don't want water in our basements. On the streets, we shun it off as quickly as possible in storm sewer systems. And so a lot of the systems that we've put in place as we've grown and developed have got it off fast. We really need to hold it on the water on the landscape longer, and we need to move to implementation of this by some method. And it really has to cut across every form of government and where the land use decisions are made.
Have any of the agencies asked us in, well, let me put it a different way. Members, what we voted on last year with some of the waters money, the new waters money, we did give money to Bowser, I think three sections of about $15 million, so that would have been about $45 million, to keep water on the land. And when we have Bowser come up, I think we'll have them talk about what they have done with that money. But each of the sections was slightly different, but it was all basically keep water on the land. And I know they've done their request for proposals, and we will hear about that. But as far as I know, that's the only agency activity right now that's going on.
Madam Chair, in response to that further would be is that we have moved, I know that the Department of Natural Resources and others have been looking at wetland restorations, we need to put buffers on, and so that it's not that there hasn't been anything done, but I think that as you remember the map that I showed how much of the land has been altered, there's a lot of area that has been altered that if we're going to have that system managed so that it cleans it up before it gets to the receiving waters or the groundwater resources, we're probably going to have to do more than we have done so far.
Okay. Members, I just will call your attention also to in the bonding bill, the one that Representative Hausman put on the table, there is $30 million for wetland restoration. That will bring in $42 million of federal money, so it's $72 million to deal with wetlands, which is the House proposal. Senate doesn't have nearly as much money. So just so you all know. Go ahead.
The next statute that is well written towards the same goal would be 103-H06, soil and water conservation policy. And just reading the first part, it says land occupiers have the responsibility to implement practices that conserve soil and water resources of the state. And so as we take that responsibility seriously in how we manage our lands and our decisions, it is written well towards what we really need to do on the points underneath that to actually improve our protection of surface and groundwater resources. So there is enabling legislation out there that does point us in the right direction. We figure out how to implement this effectively with our local partners and land managers. We can get to where we need to go.
Well, as overwhelming as this seems, we can only start with the basics. We have to understand it before we can manage it. So our program focuses on mapping, monitoring, and managing. In our opinion, this is a way to work toward healthy watersheds, which will result in sustainable quantities and high-quality water left in our systems. We're talking about surface and groundwater here. We need to sustain biodiversity so that we can have well-functioning ecosystems. Under mapping, we're talking about the County Geologic Atlas Program, aquifer characterization studies, watershed hydrology, mining hydrology, and of course, the ecosystem assessment portion done by the County Biological Survey. An example of learning to understand a system through mapping, we focus here in on the 11 County Metro. What page is that in? You may benefit to
page,
open
page 7.
Page 7 of the blue covered one. I'm just pulling it up as an example. The blue on this map that slices through the middle of Pennington County is an outline of the edge of the Crater Shane Jordan aquifer. If you look on the slice through the system that is shown at the top of the page, you can see a gray-toned Jordan sandstone. So everywhere that if you drilled a well, you come to the Jordan sandstone, that would be within that blue area. Then if you move out and look at that orange line, that shows you where, if you drilled a well, the first bedrock you'd get to would be the Franconia or the Ironton-Galesville sandstones. Again, they're on that cross-section, just deeper down, between the Mount Simon on the bottom and the Jordan that we found just a moment ago. And now that red line, way out going through Wright and Sherburne counties, notice how it's much less detailed than the squiggles on the blue or on the orange. Well, we're working on that. There's a funded program, two programs actually, with bonding money and LCCMR money, to drill wells along that edge of the Mount Simon to get more information about it. County Geologic Atlas work builds on drilling work, and the dark blue is where atlases are completed. This has been going on for quite some time, so some of the completed ones are about ready to be refreshed. Then there's the light blue where we're starting work. Cursory first looks of wide areas have been carried out, and they're called regional hydrogeologic assessments. We go back in and finish up County Geologic Atlas in those areas, and then the picture will be complete. On the monitoring side,
before you go on to the monitoring side, Representative Clark has a question.
Thank you. Actually, I just was, it's a question about the diagram on page 7 that you were referring us to. At the top of the page where it shows the, that very top portion, yep, at the top where it says simplified boundaries, it looks like the three aquifers somewhere up back, way over on the left side of the page, join or come together. Is that an accurate understanding of what's happening there, and where would that be?
Madam Chair, Representative, on the right-hand side, you mean?
Oh, on the left-hand side.
On
as
the what they're doing is coming up to the surface underneath glacial material. So they're not coming together. One is being eroded, and they're thinner there. We can't map it in good enough detail, and the graphic isn't the best.
My question is, as they are each coming up closer to the surface, it looks like they're getting pretty close to each other, and I'm just wondering what the distance is. Do they at some point actually converge, or is that just an illusion?
They do illusion? Not converge, but when they are close to the surface, they could be interconnected through cracks or improperly constructed wells.
Thank you. Madam Chair, where is that where would that be in Minnesota? Is it in Minnesota?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, the location of this cross-section is noted as A prime to A, and we drew a line across the counties, A prime to A. So you could expect these aquifers to be coming really close to the surface, probably the middle of Sherburne County, right there along the river. There's a purple line on the outline of the counties that is showing where the sliding is.
So, Madam Chair, I guess I was just looking. It looks like the Prairie du Chien one doesn't reach that far, or does it? Is it the two, the Franconia and the Mount Simon Hinckley, that get close to each other there, or is it all three? I'm just trying to understand the lay of the land.
Representative, let's see if I can get the laser pointer to go up here. This Jordan is right there.
Yeah.
It's mapped only in this portion. So everything in this area is where if you drilled a well, you could hit the Jordan. Out here, there isn't any Jordan. See, the Jordan stopped there.
Yep.
So if you're drilling the well along here, there would only be Franconia, Iron, and Galesville, the first thing you hit. So that's in here. This is where the fig, Franconia, Iron, and Galesville, it's pretty tiresome to say, is the first bedrock. So you get past this edge on the yellow, it should be where there's no more Franconia. And now you're out to where when you drill a well, all you get is Mount Simon. So in this area here, between the orange and the red, they say the Mount Simon subcrops. In other words, it's just the first bedrock you hit if you're drilling a well. Over the top is sands, clays, whatever the glacier left behind. But as far as bedrock goes, out here is only Mount Simon. And beyond that, is whatever older rock there is, crystalline bedrock typically. So by the time you're out to St. Cloud, you're under the sand, you just find some granite. That cross-section is a slice through the ground right along this line.
So, I guess when I look at that map, then it doesn't. It's probably not the case that the Franconia and the Mount Simon Hinckley meet up, get very close to each other. Is that correct? Except in Sherburne County, the Mount Simon is close itself. Am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative, the Mount Simon was put down as a layer at one point in history. Then there was another layer over the top of that. And then there was the Franconia, Ironton, Galesville layers that were put down separately. And there typically tends to be a layer between them at all points. Sometimes it's thinner, sometimes it's thicker, sometimes there's cracks through it. But they are separate in most cases, and they don't ever typically join unless it's right at the near surface point. So.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're getting to my question. I don't know if it comes up on Representative Clark's, but the communication between the aquifers, do we know that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are learning about that. It's all underground. We can't see it very well. We have limited number of wells and holes that we can look at to see what the structure of the geologic conditions are underneath the ground. The Minnesota Geological Survey, I think sometimes the U.S. Geological Survey, have done some studies. We're learning about how water moves through those systems, how it follows cracks to get from one point to another, which helps us understand how water and things that are in the water might move between aquifers as well. But our picture is fairly incomplete because we only have a few number of points on which to be able to see and predict how that system, which has an undulating surface, how water moves through and across that. And so part of what we're talking about in this proposal that will follow this is how we need to understand more if we're going to manage it sustainably. So,
just one follow-up. And the studies you referred to, are these the tracer studies? We're doing some radioactive tracer studies.
Madam Chair, Representative, County Geologic Atlas work includes collected some of the natural things that are in water and some things that have recently been added due to human activities. And then if you find them in the human-produced things, really in the deep aquifers, then you have had a tracer experiment conducted for you. So as we collect the standard sampling, we learn information, not just as you were thinking. Let me mention, though, that the depths are very deep. We could have the Mount Simon down 1,000 feet and maybe 300, 400 feet out here. So the Mount Simon in the deeper parts here is considered very well protected. The closer you are to the surface, though, the less protection there is.
Just to follow up there, do you, and we can, you can give me more information later, but I'm interested in the anthropogenic chemical sources, and I know the analytical costs are significant, but how we screen for those so we know what we're looking for, what to look for in these deeper aquifers, that's a point of interest for me.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Clark.
Just as a follow-up, is there a listing somewhere where we can find out the answer to that question, like what has been found?
Madam Chair, Representative, most of the water chemistry work is done by and housed in Pollution Control Agency, Health and Agriculture. A linked data system will eventually be able to provide the answers to anyone in any agency asking a question. The water chemistry by DNR is of a screening nature, but of a limited set of parameters. We do stable isotopes, tritium, and carbon-14 where appropriate, trace metals.
So, Madam, just a follow-up to that. So if we were interested in some of the some of the issues that the legislature's been looking at in terms of human-generated contaminants, like, for example, the 3M perfluorochemicals. Is that something that we would have to, as a legislature, ask the agency to do to look in these aquifers? I know some of that's happening over in, it has happened with some of the water sources over in Washington County and other places, but I mean, if we really wanted to find out, do we need to ask you or someone to do it, or is this going to be something that would come up on the screen? Who initiates that is part of my question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that we would need to take an interagency approach to answering those questions. I think the Health Department was actively engaged with the materials that ended up in the landfill into the aquifers in Washington County. I don't think that we have enough wells and have sampled those different aquifers for the types of things that you're potentially concerned about with lots of rigor. I think that when we discover a problem, we start to look into what causes that, and we learn a lot more about it, but I think that we would need to have potentially some direction about what you wanted accomplished across those lines. We certainly are capable of working with the other agencies saying, how do we do this? We do the hydrogeology part, try to learn about how water moves through in the different layers, and that then is easily should be coupled with what is moving, how does it get from here to there, that would start to answer some of those questions. But again, we're going to need a monitoring network that actually captures the information and tracks it over the long term to be able to predict that.
Representative Clark, we will have the Pollution Control Agency do their, they're going to do the third one, and I think that will be next Tuesday.
Oh, thank you.
So,
thank you.
Did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I just to follow up on this interagency. This is a pretty big deal, and we should have something back from all of the agencies and just how we're cooperating and using the best available science and screening tools for these analytes that we believe we should be looking for in these deep aquifers. I think that should be an interagency approach, not just MPCA.
I'll return, and what we were talking about was mapping, monitoring, and managing. And we're here at the monitoring segment. We do climate monitoring. We have surface water installations. We measure lake levels with a whole bunch of volunteers. We get lake outflows. We have stream grade flow gauging stations. We have a groundwater level observation network, which we affectionately call OBWELS. And we hope to be able to start monitoring springs and seeps because they are an expression of surface water and groundwater interaction and may be, in a sense, the canary in the coal mine for whether groundwater flows contributing to surface water flows remain in place. And we also will be monitoring and have been monitoring natural heritage information and county biological survey information. As an example of the kind of climatology information that you can right today find on the DNR webpage are climate maps and stream flow reports. And you can get some real-time information off the website if you have a favorite stream gauge you'd like to check up on. You can click right through and see what it's doing and look at a picture of it. Then managing. What we're involved in pretty intensely at the moment is evaluating water supply plans created by water suppliers of over a certain size, 1,000 people. We have some resource protection plans in place. We would hope to have some drainage law reform as it is in direct conflict with the statute we were just talking about. We wish to improve data management and data sharing so that PCA, Ag, Health, and anybody else who needs access to the information can find it. We have our water appropriation permit program, and on each program permit we can and do place requirements, conditions. For example, the DNR's part of managing soil and water conservation is to ensure that on irrigation permits there are appropriate soil conservation measures in place, and it's part of their water appropriation permit. And as a holistic type of program, we're moving into an era where we're probably going to have to use groundwater management areas as a planning tool.
I'll just give you a quick example of managing and how we can look at managing water and surface and groundwater resources using some of the tools. Obviously, we have the hydrologic system here. We have a watershed on which when rain falls, it flows certain directions, follows into streams and into the lakes. We need to manage and keep track of those systems in that watershed context so that we see where water is coming from and where it goes to. Here's an example from down in the Austin area. We've taken the LIDAR that you have funded and used that information, which is detailed topography that we can tell from the imaging, and we can lay it over the landscape. We can put the stream layers on there, and basically, if you look in the top left of this diagram, that's called hydrograph, and that just shows that over time how water flows off the landscape. And as we have changed the system to make sure that water flows off as quickly as possible in this particular area for cropping systems, because it's important, it causes, after a rainfall event, the water rises very quickly, flows through the system, and goes down quickly. And as that happens, basically it's capable of carrying a lot of stuff with it, soils, other nutrients, chemicals, whatever we put on the landscape, whatever is not able to be treated or buffered. And so the hydrograph rises quickly, it goes down quickly under the current system on how we've managed the water off the landscape. If we're looking to hold water on the landscape longer, some of the tools that we could use is that we've discussed at some points and others have considered is culvert downsizing. If we made the sizes of the openings a little bit smaller so it doesn't get off as quickly, we ran a scenario using this the models that we have available to us plus the LIDAR, and we could see where if we made the culvert sizes smaller, where it would start to pound and how long it would be held there, and that would enable us working with local U.S. government saying, would this be an acceptable solution on places where we could hold water? If we wanted to look at, and if you look on the upper left again, is that if we were to do that and we ran the model again to say how quickly would water flow off the landscape, you can see that it doesn't go, it goes up very quickly, but it slows it down coming off and extends it out longer, and that holds it in the landscape longer and allows for best management practices to treat it. If we were to even look further at that and say, naturally, if water fell when it precipitated, where would it typically be held and ponded and stored? And these show, the dark blue areas show areas where it would typically have been held. There are the depressions, the low spots in the landscape. And using this tool, we can also then say, how would this be acceptable way to do it? But it certainly it provides us some tools to say, if we're going to manage it and treat it to protect the different groundwater resources, where can we do this and what would the impacts be? And it would help people make decisions about what was acceptable and unacceptable. But as you see in the hydrograph above again, is that it causes to be much less of a peak, much less water coming off. It's slower, it allows it to infiltrate, and it comes off more slowly. And so then it will ultimately come off cleaner that way as well. So,
Madam Chair, nice. Does that map represent a location in Minnesota? And if so, do you know where it is?
Madam Chair, a representative, that is a watershed near the Austin area in the Turtle Creek watershed, Cedar River watershed, and it's a sub-watershed that we have done some modeling. They are looking at trying to reduce the amount of water coming off their landscape because they have flooding problems in Austin, and so we've been cooperating with them to help them understand how the hydrology or the land surface and the water interaction works and where there would be options to manage things differently. Moving along, we get to the funding parts. Part of the challenge was what would the cost of programs to deliver this. that we put together an estimate of 10 and 25-year costs to do adequate mapping, monitoring, and managing needs here.
Could you tell us what page is that?
That is on in the green report, mm-hmm. and it is on page 2. And so it's a compilation. These are the activities that the Department of Natural Resources, we know what we can do as part of the equation. The next slide I'll talk to is about the other parties. But these are the mapping, monitoring, and managing products and tools that we could do to help provide this, looking at it over a 10 and 25-year period.
Here's one of the problems. I mean, I can see mapping. It's more specific to you. Well, no, it isn't either. Mapping, monitoring. But when you look at management needs, you're looking only at your department. And it is difficult for us to see what we need from multiple departments since water is scattered. So analytically, this is not getting us to where we need to be. But I just point that out because it looks like, well, management needs are not a very big dollar amount when I suspect if we're looking at the big picture problem, the management needs are a far larger amount.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. Our capacity to analyze what it would take for each agency and government to do this was limited in the time frame. We did provide some references to ways that we could raise money, and also there's an attachment on the back that more specifically refers to what we could do. But I'll move to the next slide. This is the part that we don't have ownership of, but certainly we recognize that as we talk about long-term surface and groundwater protection, it needs to involve all of our partners, our landowners, our local units of government, other state agencies, the federal government, and other partners, NGOs, in providing solutions. And so they are managing needs in relative, we do more of the mapping and monitoring. That's our expertise area. When it gets to be managing, that is land use decisions in most cases, that is delivered at a local unit of government level, and that is where the funding probably would need to be targeted if we're going to deliver this properly. And the state agencies can help and provide support and tools and understanding of how the systems work, but it will have to be delivered at a local unit of government level with agencies contributing their part to this, to the solution. So we weren't prepared to be able to answer how much that would cost and how we put that together, but we certainly would work in an interagency cooperation way with the legislature and attempting to address that.
Representative Purcell has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just looking at the monitoring needs here and reading that over, and I don't see analytical in there, and as far as chemical, and I know it was referenced earlier that you do work with other federal agencies, et cetera, and pollution control agency, et cetera. That just seems to be, you know, a need that really sticks out there. I don't know how we're going to do that analytical chemistry.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I have been a part of an interagency team with Health, Ag, PCA, and Met Council. We've included Bowser at times and EQB as well. We've had discussions in regards to the water quality components and the water quantity. We have more expertise on the quantity side. They have the expertise in the quality. And as we look at how water quality concerns, and that's largely what you're talking about, is that the composition of what's in that water and how it gets from here to there, that does need to be brought together, and we need to look at how we're going to manage those systems. Our part of that is helping the other agencies understand how it can get from here to there and how it moves through the system. Then we have to look at what is being put in and the different agencies' responsibilities on the quality part, and there's three different agencies that have pieces of that, and how we put that together in a package. This is leading towards that, but and this next report will get into that in more detail about the 11 county area.
Very good. Do I understand that from your comments that there is an interagency team at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, there is a team that where we have been talking about groundwater protection strategies. We've actually working with actually through support to the Clean Water Council as well that has these same concerns that what are the appropriate groundwater protection strategies for quality and quantity, and there's also a surface water monitoring and protection strategies that we have been working on with interagency team saying, how do we do this more effectively together?
Madam Chair, one final. Are the feds on your team?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. We coordinate actively with the U.S. Geological Survey, the Minnesota Geological Survey. They bring part of the equation. I'm not saying that we have full integration of everybody that needs to be, but we have good start on that, and we've been working at it. We've been working over time, but it, obviously, as we get to water sustainability questions, the need to do that increases.
Thank you.
Members, I'll just call to your attention, when you look at the funding amounts in the 10-year plan, the way I look at it, and you can check my math on this, it's $16 million per year just to DNR. For mapping and monitoring needs, and I keep coming back to the question of why some of, as you have been giving permits to users, you haven't had them participate in this need to map and monitor on a greater extent, so you're not saying to the general public, hey, you got to pay for this because the users aren't paying. So I think that's a question that this committee needs to wrestle with. So continue, but I saw that as a question. When I looked at $16 million here per year, and I will guess that Ag will have a big dollar, and I will guess that PCA will have a big dollar. We're running into money way beyond anything in the Clean Water Fund.
Production of the report on development of a groundwater level monitoring network for the 11 county metro area gives us an example, something to show you how this might work, the monitoring portion at least that we've been talking about. Kent has probably said this several times when coming to testify in front of you. We cannot manage what we do not measure. We don't know what's going on. How are we going to predict what will happen? How can we measure what has happened? Why does it matter? Most of the metropolitan area, the growing metropolitan area, depends 100% on groundwater. That's the darkest blue tone or teal, whatever. The cities in the middle are Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they have some surface water component. But the rest draw 100% from groundwater. Groundwater use is on the rise. This graphic shows population, those are the dots with the thin lines, rising, and water use possibly rising above the rate of population growth. Of course, you need to remember that there are wet years and dry years, and the water use responds when we have dry years. Well, as we set forth to try to develop a monitoring network that would make sense, we decided it would be quite reasonable and much less work to figure out what the experts at the national level have been doing. We drew on the Water Quality Monitoring Committee's work and on the committee that developed the National Groundwater Level Monitoring Plan and adopted those basic outlines. And I would hope that you would believe me when I said it wasn't that much different than what we would have intended to do anyway. We were on the right track. You have to work together. You have to coordinate between agencies and locals. You have to communicate just as much, and you have to change direction in mid-course if you have identified a need for change. And everything has to be coordinated in that way to result in an understanding, protection, and restoration of the resource. DNR's proposal that we developed for this report was submitted to the National Committee on Water, the National Advisory Committee on Water, to be a pilot program. And we were selected. So now we have been assigned technical representatives, one at National USGS and one National EPA, to help us build national interconnectivity into our water management information systems. The group that's working together on this does include PCA and Ag and Health. So ultimately, our information can be shared across state boundaries. We don't have sheet pile at our state boundaries. And so being able to switch to get information from Iowa or Wisconsin or South Dakota or North Dakota will be quite useful. The network goals are to create a network of our networks, use them uniformly statewide, use the information to fill knowledge gaps, know exactly what the questions are, the base questions. You can't know what the next emerging problem might be, but if you have sound information on the background, you're better positioned to deal with the next thing that comes up. We will be looking at the data as they come in, analyze them, perhaps develop automated routines to check for information that's called outliers, something that looks fishy, so you're called to check on it. And we will create standard products, such as what you would see now if you clicked on your favorite rain gauge. Here's the idea of a network of networks. The top thing's a network, the bottom thing's a network. The labels on them, though you can't read it, would be stressed network, and the other one is targeted network, which for a water level measuring person means the place that's not stressed. A well in an unstressed network is not near a pumping well. It responds to climate, it responds to land use change, but it's not bouncing up and down every time a well somewhere turns on and starts pumping. We do need that kind of information, though, so that's in the stressed network. And sometimes wells that were unstressed, as population grows and some water use increases, will turn into stressed wells. What is it we seek to learn? What have we designed the network for? We want to know how the systems work. We want to know where water goes in and comes out. We want to know how groundwater chemistry is changing. And we want to know how our management impacts the things we care about. Are we keeping ecosystems healthy? Are recharge areas being maintained? Is discharge still occurring in the right places? Has chemistry, natural chemistry, been sustained? How do you design a network to do that? Well, first you have to figure out where your aquifers are, and of course our mapping works on that. You have to know what resources might be threatened, so we have to know with good mapping where springs, streams, and lakes are, and you have to have coordinated level and flow measurements in those surface resources. The agencies have to work together, and they work together much more eagerly when each agency recognizes the benefits they stand to gain through this interaction. We need to standardize day-to-day operations so that we do things right. If we do things right, people will trust our data, and then even if they're drawing it from the national interconnection and receiving our data, they'll know it can be trusted. Standard procedures, day-to-day operations, good practices. Right now what we have are, if you wanted to think of it this way, there are already four networks. Department of Natural Resources are the words written in blue. Primarily we have water level monitoring going on. Health, PCA, and Ag primarily have water chemistry monitoring going on. But of course they would measure water levels every time they go to a well. Notice that we've deliberately drawn some wells deeper and some wells shallower, and even in one case we put two wells right next to each other. Well, that's the definition of a well nest, at least two wells in one place, and that creates an efficiency. So let's imagine we had one deep well in our current water level monitoring network, we could create a wellness by going there once we've made sure this is a location we'll be able to keep for the long term and drilling a shallow well near it. What would that look like if you went to visit? Well, down in Dakota County, you could see this is only two wells. Those other six posts are to keep farm equipment or something else from hitting the wells. And the word is bollard. I didn't know that for the longest time. I called them protection posts. Here's that image again. Now, if you were drilling a well in that blue area, the stack of aquifers you have available to you is greater because the stack of aquifers is thicker. So if you drill a well in the southeast part of these 11 counties, you could have a Mount Simon well, you could have a Franconia Iron Galesville well, you could have a Jordan well, you could have a well in the glacial material up above. So maybe you'd put four wells in a nest. Maybe there's two things of interest in the upper layer, maybe five wells. And maybe we put them in the right place so that when chemistry samples are taken, they would be of interest to health, PCA, and ag. We can coordinate our work. So here's an example. If you have the report, this is our own observation well network. In that blue outlined area, you can see dots of all different colors because depending on what depth you drill to, you could get so many different aquifers.
We're on page 15 of the blue report.
Once you get out to the northwest of the area, though, your dots are going to eat either Mount Simon or surficial material. So you're limited to the Christmas colors of red for the Mount Simon and green for the surficial material.
As you go through, we have exactly 10 minutes left for this, and we need to finish up this because there is a proposal here,
okay,
and people need to understand what the proposal is.
We can build our network from our existing networks. As you were, Representative Borghinius, saying beforehand, there are people who have permits. We can ask them for information. This is a map of where people have permits. This is a map of where there are public water supply wells. As long as data are collected frequently enough so that we can get the detail, this hydrograph here, which is a trace of water levels, shows the difference between getting monthly readings, which would be the blue line, relatively smooth, and having an automated piece of equipment that gets water levels on a more consistent basis. If you have equipment in place that is already collecting such information, maybe for operational reasons, then why not collect it, save it, transmit it, and put it in a water level monitoring network? And here's another population that in many cases already do have permit conditions requiring them to collect the information. These are permits with authorizations of 100 million gallons a year or more. Now, they don't necessarily pump that much, but they would be authorized to in, for example, the driest of years. To create this network of networks, the baseline portion, the portion we feel the state really is responsible for, those unstressed wells outside the direct zone of impact of a pumping well. We have calculated these costs. They're found on page 4 of the blue report, and they are repeated in the back of the blue report on page 41.
That completes our report, unless there are questions.
Well, I think you have to say, let's look at the chart on page 41. You had originally told us that we needed 6,000 monitoring wells across the state. And operationally, how many do we have right now?
Approximately 750.
Okay, so we're short over 5,000 wells. What you're proposing here is for the metropolitan area, and members, just look across these numbers at the top, and you can see what it is, I mean, what you need and what you're asking for here is a total of 380 wells. So it's a small portion of the, what would ideally be 6,000 wells. Am I right about that?
Madam Chair, yes, you're correct.
Okay. So this is a small portion, but it's in the metropolitan area. You have calculated, as we asked you to do and you haven't mentioned yet, what it would cost per gallon of water. And why don't you explain that to members? If viewers were to pay for this, what's the cost per gallon of water?
As one proceeds to develop the network, costs aren't just maintenance. The 6,000 wells would be a sum of stressed and unstressed. So our 380 gets us probably all the way to a metropolitan unstressed backbone network. The rest of those wells would be outstate, and the stressed network are the responsibility of the appropriators. And you'll see then that after these first 4 years, where it's close to $18 per million gallons, and you say per million gallons because the permits are in million gallons, that is, these numbers are so small they're hard to talk about, 0.001769 cents per gallon. So you get a million of those gallons and it's $17.69. Once all the wells are in, the wells that aren't working are sealed, the equipment is in place, maintenance and proper checking up on the wells to make sure everything's okay is only $5.89 per million gallons only. But at that point, you have confidence in your information. It's served on the web. The data systems are in place. There's constant screening of what's in the data system. We can respond to trouble, and when we have interference or water use conflicts, we have the background data to jump right in and try to help solve the problem.
Madam Chair, the additional answer is that the 6,000 network, as we would look at all of Minnesota, obviously this is just the metropolitan Loveland County where we think we need to start. We are in the process of looking at where we have other concerns in aquifers around the state, and we would want to target that based on growth or risk or threat to the aquifers and place wells in where we would be able to then understand more of the characteristics of those aquifers that are under stress or pressure or use concerns. And so we would build that out as we go based on information we need to know in advance, as well as having users pay for some of the costs of monitoring those systems as they use it.
Members, what we need is specificity. We've only got specificity for this thing in the metropolitan area. And you see the numbers here. I want us to have specificity for other places where we're having problems out in Clay and Wilkin counties or maybe in Bonanza Valley. We don't have the specificity, but here we do. And you can see that it's an $8 million project to finish it across the metropolitan area. Huge tax base, fairly small amount of money. And the maintenance is less than $1 million a year. Am I getting this correct? Just so members see, this is the one specific proposal coming out of all of these studies. So I just wanted to call your attention to that. I think from the legislature's point of view, we need more specificity in all of this kind of work. And we're going to come back and ask you for more specificity because we can't deal in generalities. It's just very difficult. So we have some questions here.
Yeah, I think Representative Ansels,
do you have a question? No. Representative Ansels, did you have a question? Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're asking them to come back so that we know exactly how much they're going to be charging, say, a homeowner versus maybe a business and so forth? Or are we going to be able to get some of those details?
Well, I think what it costs per gallon down here. I think we had asked that. We do have that number here. So
do you think maybe we could have either the chamber or one of those organizations come in and give us some statistics on how much say, the top three businesses in the state, how much water they use, and so how we can see exactly how much of an increase in cost this is going to be for those businesses.
Do you think we need to give them a subsidy? Is that what we're aiming for?
No, what I'm asking is I want to know what the cost is going to be as an increase. So we just have an idea of how much we're going to be increasing for that. And then also just on the average homeowner, how much do they use in a given year? So, I mean, I know you're saying that it's how many cents per gallon, but, you know, I personally don't know how much an average homeowner uses.
Okay. Look at,
I think that would be helpful, just so we know what we're talking about in concrete numbers from anyone from the individual homeowner to, say, a company here in the state.
I will bring some numbers in, since I'm a Minneapolis water user, and we pay the highest rates in the system, I mean, of anybody. The most telling thing about the rates we pay is we consume a lot less water per household. So that I will get that for you, too. It's just an interesting observation.
Madam Chair, are you sure that's because of, you know, that you pay the higher rates? I've got folks that I know that live in Minneapolis, and they just don't like the water, so they purchase the water, too.
Well, maybe they haven't tasted it recently. In taste tests across, I mean, some of the best taste tests done, Minneapolis has the best water in any of the systems. So we aren't going to, we'll have maybe a blind taste test in this committee. Would that be fun? We're going to do a couple more questions. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be a hopelessly naive question, and if it is, then just let me know that. But it seems to me if we need 6,000 wells to monitor water quality, we have a gazillion private wells in the state of Minnesota, and I just wonder how much outreach we've done to try to get data from the wells that are already there. I've always wanted to know what's in the well water that I drank growing up in Andover, just south of a Superfund site. I mean, it just seems like there's probably a lot of willing homeowners that would just voluntarily participate. Now, the reason why I wonder if that's hopelessly naive is the communication expense and dealing with that, I'm sure, is complicated. But I don't know if the type of pipes that you're using is a very specific specification, so you're not getting leaching off the metal and things like that.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's a pump in your well, and there's some difficulty in getting the measurement instrument down there and installed. We do that sometimes in an area where we're trying to figure out what's actually happened to somebody's well. We're talking about a water level monitoring network. So to get the water levels accurately, we'd rather be in a well that doesn't have a pump in it. And when somebody comes back again and again to a well, they're very careful to disinfect their equipment, but when you probably wouldn't really want them putting the tape, no matter how well disinfected, in your well, unless there was a need for you, unless you wanted it done.
I'm sure, just to follow up, I guess what I had been focusing more on, and this is all a little bit over my head because I'm now a water expert, was the what's in the water more than the water level, and that is a different kind of monitoring. And it just raises is the question, you know, I think it was on earlier, page 13 of the blue booklet, of how many different agencies are responsible for different looks at the same water for different reasons. So maybe my question would have been more properly geared for somebody here from the Minnesota Department of Health who's looking at the water for a different reason.
That structural question that you have, we hope, and the money that we gave to the University of Minnesota to do a 25-year water plan, that they will give us some guidance on changing structure.
Governance.
So that, I mean, it's a good question, but I think the agencies have not been able to answer that, and so that's why we ask the U. So with that, members, I think we're going to have to call a halt to this. We are going to have to be having further discussions because obviously this is one of the things we've got to grapple with and deal with. So we will, that's our job, we will do that. Right now, members, I want, just before we get the VHS, I want to have Mr. Reinholtz, because it will only take a minute, Representative Anderson, you had asked a question about could we do the same thing for other pieces of DNR that we did for trails. We're starting that. It's not going to be quick, but here we go. Mr. Reinholz.
Madam Chair, members, the piece I will be referring to is titled DNR Parks. It's a landscape spreadsheet. Very similar to with the same types of information on the one that we handed out and I talked about on trails at the last meeting, I believe. This one, what I'm trying to lay out here is what it would cost to do two things in parks. One is to complete what the Parks Division calls their deferred maintenance. They did give us a list of deferred maintenance items. It was approximately $100 million. So this list of deferred maintenance starts out with outstanding funding needs of $100 million. And as I did in the parks, I tried to come up with what would be a doable, both in terms of the agency's ability to do things and also the amount of bonding and funding available. When, what kind of schedule would get rid of that? You can see here I'm using legacy money, which is really listed at $2 million per year out all the way out to when it's finished, which actually is 2023, and also bonding at $10 million per cycle. What it would end up with, I mean, there's still a small amount left, but basically we'll finish that deferred maintenance in the year 2023. So you can see it takes quite a while, even at a considerably higher level of funding than we have in recent past been giving to the parks, in order to eliminate that deferred maintenance. The acquire in holdings, the next section of the spreadsheet, similar to what I did on the parks, I said we have 42,000 acres within park boundaries that are not owned currently by the state. So the question that I'm trying to answer is how long would it take for the state to actually acquire all the land that is now within state parks but not owned by the state? I used an average amount of spending that the DNR estimated per acre on this. That can vary greatly, obviously, depending on parcel, but I used a number over a relatively large period of purchases or number of purchases, so it should be all right. And what you can see here, it's just an unbelievable long period of time. At a bonding level of $7 million every cycle to just acquire, this is not improved, just acquire, and an environmental trust money, which has been used in recent years also to acquire land, and I kept it at approximately the same level that it was at. It would take a total investment of $588 million to buy that land that's already been authorized for purchase basically within state parks but never been funded, and it would take at this level of about $1 million a year of environmental trust and a $7 million each bonding cycle till 2139 to purchase that land. I'm just trying to put in context, you know, what's the funding. These aren't really commitments that have been made, but perhaps in a sense some sort of expectation and what it would cost and how long it would be to get there. Maybe something to consider if new state parks are being authorized or considered, that we already have a huge financial commitment. Perhaps another way to look at it is perhaps we should go back and revisit the boundaries of some of these parks and make a determination on what priorities there are, because there's a large number. The acres is way beyond what we are going to purchase anywhere in any sort of planning future that is realistic. The last part is just really just giving you some context on operation and maintenance. It shows really the current funding for operation and maintenance in the parks. Obviously, acquiring these in-holdings, on the trails one, I had an estimate that would increase all those. These in-holdings can vary greatly depending on, and just acquiring them doesn't really drive costs. It's the improvements that drive costs, and I wasn't making any estimate on improvements here, so I really didn't try to estimate operations, but they would also go up considerably if improvements were made on acquired holdings. Madam Chair, that's just really that was what I was trying to show with this, and I would answer any questions.
I think that's extraordinarily helpful work,
so we get a sense in this committee about what's really out there that has to be done. We will continue on this process. I've asked DNR to look at WMAs and AMAs, do the same thing. We'll just keep on going. Yes, we're going to talk about VHS. Can we hold this question and just have about 30 seconds on VHS so folks who are here just can give you a very quick update on its new appearances?
Good morning. Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife Director, DNR. With me is Roy Johannes from our fisheries section. 2 weeks ago, Cornell University announced, as a result of some research they're conducting, that they found evidence of VHS at two sites in Wisconsin and two sites in Michigan. The two sites in Wisconsin were in the Duluth and Superior Harbors. Cornell was using a new detection technique, and Mr. Johannes can describe that in more detail if you'd like, but these findings haven't been confirmed with kind of the gold standard of cell culture to see if we could isolate the virus. But nevertheless, the researchers believe that the virus likely is in Lake Superior. It's disappointing news. It's not necessarily surprising. We've seen VHS move from east to west through the Great Lakes system, and we certainly anticipated that it would likely get here. I guess the good news, if there is any, is that I think we're as prepared as we could be. We have already made changes in some of our fisheries management programs and our hatchery operations in anticipation of VHS arriving on the lake. We've got surveillance systems in place to detect VHS both in Lake Superior and other waters in the state, and in waters where we're raising fish. And then, of course, we did have the legislation that we worked with you 2 years ago to pass, so that we had the necessary authorities to manage this disease, control movement of water and fish and that sort of thing. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Johannes, and he can provide a little more detail as far as steps we've taken related to VHS.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Roy Johannes. I'm with the Fishery Section. I did put together a handout that we could pass out to the members if you'd like. But basically, what we've done over the last few years, as David mentioned, is that we've accomplished quite a bit of surveillance in inland waters. And through grants that we've received from USD APHIS, we were able to conduct surveillance on our recreational lakes. And the last few years, we've also worked on looking at private facilities and their stocking of public waters and assisted them with testing. As we looked at VHS in 2007, as we prepared for the upcoming year, we looked at from the DNR standpoint that we had two vectors which we would see VHS arriving in Minnesota. One was Lake Superior because of its connection to the Great Lakes, and the other is through the Mississippi River. And with that, we needed to take actions that would prevent any movement of water or live fish from those basins to prevent the spread of VHS if it did show up. Fortunately for us, we've had an invasive species program, and because we've had invasive species in Lake Superior and the Mississippi River, there are steps in place to prevent the movement of fish and water from those waters. But however, we've continued to do surveillance measures at both of those waters to make sure that we didn't have VHS in Lake Superior or the Mississippi River. Our French River hatchery was a key component on Lake Superior. It's located just north of Duluth, and we've taken a number of actions to help us get through this scenario. The first one is that we had a walleye spawning operation in the St. Louis River, which we discontinued, and we moved that up to our Pike River or Lake Vermilion scenario, so that we now replace any of those eggs or walleye fry and walleye fingerling stocking from the Vermilion strain. We discontinued use the French River hatchery as the short-term holding facility for trout. that were moved up to the northeast part of the state from our southern hatcheries so that they would not be exposed to any water. Although we do have a very sophisticated filtering process with ultraviolet filtering at the French River hatchery. We also hatch the number of white sucker eggs that we use for forage at the Duluth hatchery. We discontinued that and went to dry feed, and that was primarily for our muskellunge program. We also have been testing all of our inland egg takes for VHS, and in 2009 we were able to test all of our fish that we stocked that are susceptible to VHS as part of our program. We continue to work with the Great Lakes Fish Health Committee in developing standards and reviewing processes for VHS.
I think, members, this just gives you kind of an update, and I appreciate this from the agency. We are running out of time, but I would also ask if you find additional information on when you find additional information on VHS, will you let us know, and we would like you to come back and just keep us updated on this, if you would do that?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Thank you for providing this. I mean, I think this is helpful. Thank you. Okay. Members, we are a little over time. I don't like to do that, but I thought this was important for folks to see. On Thursday, we will start with PCA. We're coming back to DNR. We're just going to rotate through the committees, as I said at the beginning. Thank you all for being here. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.